From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later on, Twilight of the Chariots of the Gods with Eric Von Daniken. Get ready for that as we go live to Europe in a few hours with Eric. And of course, as you know, the History Channel is doing Ancient Aliens all because of Eric Von Daniken and his work. Here's what's happening. Social Security recipients, and there are a lot of them out there, will get a raise in January, the first increase in benefits since 2009. Experts project the increase will be about 3.5%. And tomorrow, about 55 million beneficiaries will find out for sure. The annual cost of living adjustment, or COLA, is based on a measurement of inflation that Congress adopted back in the 1970s. Since then, it has resulted in annual increases averaging about 4.2%, but there was no COLA in 2010 or 11 because they say inflation was way too low. That, however, has been a small comfort to the millions of retirees, disabled people, people who depend on Social Security, who have seen their retirement accounts dwindle and their home values drop during the economic downturn. So some shades of good news there. Greg Hunter, USA Watchdog, with us. Greg, finally, a little good news for people who probably need it, huh?
It is good news for people who need it. Of course, the real inflation rate, if you did it the way Bureau of Labor Statistics did it, without all the accounting gimmicks to make things look better than what it really is, according to John Williams at ShadowStats.com, is in the neighborhood of about 11%. So they're giving you 4%, and it's really 11%, so they're still taking about an 8%, 7%, you know, hit in inflation adjustments.
What's new these days on the economic front beyond this, Greg?
Well, everybody was so happy today. The stock market surged. There's news that the European Union is going to deploy a $2 trillion euro rescue fund now, although that's still not completely sold. And everybody thinks the crisis is over, but the crisis is far from over. This is not going to be resolved until there are many banks that fail. According to Jim Rickards, who is a big wig at Tangent Capital, big thinker, he's an insider, he says, hey, listen, the bonds are definitely going to crash and burn. The bonds are toast. The banks own the bonds. If the bonds are toast, the banks are toast. And he thinks there's going to be many bankruptcies. So does Meredith Whitney, banking star banking analyst, who a few years ago said Citi was going to have to cut their dividend when it was a $50 stock. And, of course, she was right. If you take a look at the leverage, it's 40-1 by some for some banks, and you know there are five banks here in the U.S. that have what 50-1, nearly 50-1 leverage, and you know $235 trillion in derivatives. This whole thing could set off a daisy chain of defaults, and that's not just a few analysts who are saying that. Even Tim Geithner has warned about that as early as last month. So, what's going to happen? Is there's going to be bank defaults. This is not going to get handled cleanly. It's not going to get handled without some messy, messy defaults and people losing some money.
All right, Greg. Greg Hunter. By the way, just last week, the FDIC closed down Sun Security Bank in Missouri. 29 locations took them over. It's just starting. Ford Motor Company installing a feature in its new vehicles and many of its older ones that can read text messages out loud. The feature, which is intended to reduce texting while driving, is part of Ford's voice-activated technology called Sync and is already installed on all model 2012 Ford vehicles, with the exception of the Ford Ranger. BlackBerry, the company that makes it, Research in Motion, is to give BlackBerry users more than $100 worth of free apps as a way of apologizing for the outage that took down the smartphone's email service for 3 days last week across many parts of the world. The Canadian company said that the October 19th through the end of the year, customers would be able to download from a selection of premium apps on the BlackBerry App World Store, including games and a selection of hands-free voice-to-text programs. BlackBerry will add to its current list of 12 titles over the next 12 months. When Apple released its new operating system to go with the iPhone 4S, it touted a new app called Find My Friends as a great way to track and meet up with people. If they agree, you can see their locations on a map on your screen, but the app's enterprising customers are apparently already finding some other uses. If the online posts appearing on a chat form are real, Find My Friends may have already claimed its very first victim, a marriage. Saturday night, A man saying he lived in New York City posted this. Divorcing wife, thanks iPhone 4S, and find my friends. And he said, I got my wife a new 4S, loaded up my find my friends without her knowing. She told me she was at her friend's house in East Village. Well, I had suspicions about her meeting a guy who lived uptown. Lo and behold, find my friends has her right there at the guy spot. Oh, well, technology. Police in Everett, Washington say a woman is accused of cutting her sleeping husband's neck and shoulder with a power saw. Officers who arrived at the home said they could hear the man shouting, you tried to cut off my head. You're going to jail. Police say the woman told officers she grabbed the saw because an intruder escaped out of her daughter's window, and that's who she thought it was. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez says about 2 years to live, according to his former doctor. He is, of course, 57 years old. He's been fighting 4 rounds of chemotherapy in Cuba because of a cancerous tumor. British billionaire Richard Branson opened the world's very first commercial spaceport in New Mexico, the new home for his company, Virgin Galactic. Spaceport America will start sending people up into space. Already 150 people have already booked for travel on the first flights to orbit, according to the company. Robert Zubrin with us. Robert, this is exciting, but is it really going to happen?
Well, it might happen, but first of all, they're not taking people to orbit. They're taking people on joyrides up to about 100 kilometers altitude, but it's only a 4-minute ride, and then you drop. So you get to experience zero gravity for 4 minutes, but that's it. You don't actually get to go into orbit.
They're $200,000 a trip. That's a lot of money for a little 4-minute flight, huh?
Yeah, you could do a pretty good around-the-world vacation for $200,000. And so this is something that has a limited appeal, and a certain number of people are going to do it. I mean, for certain people who are loaded with money, it's worth $2,000 to be the first person to experience this. But how about the 34th, and how about the 137th? I think at a certain point, this business plan runs out of steam.
All right, Robert Zubrin, thank you so much. Robert's website is part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, we're going to be talking about a crime scene investigator with related ghost stories and also forbidden archaeology on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Looking forward to a couple hours here. Paul Ramosh with us, graduated from college with a Bachelor of Science in Criminalistics. Paul has spent the last 14 years working as a crime scene investigator for Weber Metro CSI and is very active in forensic science, education, law enforcement training. Quite varied background, as you'll find out over the next couple hours. Paul, welcome to Coast with his new book, The Lost Stones. Good to have you with us, Paul.
Oh, thank you, George. It's truly an honor to be with you tonight.
What's it like being a CSI investigator?
Well, I can say one thing. It's nothing like the TV show.
Really? It's not that romantic?
No, we get that all the time. You show up on a scene and people will quiz you and, oh, what's the show? And, you know, is what you do just like the show? And sometimes depends on what good of a mood I'm in, I'll say, well, the only thing similar between the show in reality is the name. And sometimes people don't like to hear that. But yeah, the TV show really overemphasizes things that don't really exist in forensic science. And a lot of times the turnaround time that they have is pretty exaggerated. But it's good that it's generated interest in our field.
How did a crime scene investigator get involved, get interested in forbidden archaeology, ghost stories? How in the heck did this happen?
Well, it's your fault, George.
Uh-oh. I'll take the blame.
Yeah, it's a long story, and I do place a lot of the blame or the credit to Coast to Coast, because there are so many police officers and crime scene investigators, first responders, who live by your show, who love it. And, you know, I'll drive up to a scene and I'll have the radio playing, and so many people be like, oh, George Norrie, you listen to that too? And, I mean, they're so excited. And so after working for years and years and listening to your show, there's so many ideas that you expose the people to, and it's just so wonderful. And so a lot of the topics that I write about in my book and a lot of my interest in the paranormal have come from your show. But also, it makes sense, really, because the person who trained me, who brought me along in the business, is named Russ Dean, and he's a professor still of criminal justice up at Weber State University, where I graduated. And when he taught me the business, he always said, don't get tunnel vision. When you go to investigate a crime, when you show up on a crime scene, don't have preconceived notions for what you're going to find. Go where the evidence takes you. And I mean, this is how I was brought up in this business and taught. And that's what Coast to Coast is all about. I mean, you follow the evidence. You do not take the preconceived notions that you've learned from your science teachers and history professors, but you know, you follow where the evidence goes.
Paul, tell me about The Lost Stones. This is, I assume, your first book.
It is, and I'm very excited about it. It is the product of a lot of research and a lot of different things that, like I said, I've heard on Coast to Coast. And what it is it's almost a treatise on science, how modern science and the academic establishment really doesn't want us to know all the truths that are out there. And really where it kind of the genesis of it is, as growing up as a Mormon, as a member of the LDS faith, I had to kind of compartmentalize my faith and the things that you know, I was taught in church, the things I read in the Bible, the things that I read in the Book of Mormon, and what I was taught in science class. And you have to compartmentalize that because you're often told that, or you're always told by scientists that the things that have to do with faith cannot be proven. There's no proof out there. And, you know this, George. I mean, you're a deeply spiritual man, and the things that we believe in cannot be proved scientifically, and that's drubbed into us from the scientists that are out there. But as I began to study, and my eyes were really opened by many of the guests that you've had on your show, that there actually is a lot of very interesting things out there that show that people did come by boat to America before Columbus. And a lot of the research that is into the book, it are, like I said, are things that I've learned on Coast to Coast.
Well, there's no question that, you know, I think there have been visitors to this region probably way before people even can imagine. And they're out there. And we're going to get into a lot of this as we talk with you tonight, Paul. I'm curious about your paranormal experience as an investigator. Have you come across very strange things?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as you said, I've worked in this business. I've worked in doing crime scenes for 14 years. And yeah, we've come across a lot of very interesting and very paranormal things.
Give us an example. What have you seen?
Well, there's a lot of interesting stories that I could tell. One of the ones that I kind of want to focus on, and I don't know if later you're planning on taking calls.
Oh, yeah, we're going to do that next hour with you.
What I would really be interested in is the story that I want to tell you first has to do with one of my good friends and colleagues named Mitch, who actually brought a ghost home with him from a crime scene.
Ooh, tell me.
And what maybe before I start, if we could maybe have a special line for other cops, crime scene investigators, first responders to call in, because I'm really interested if this has happened to anybody else.
We can do that.
Okay, so I don't know if that's possible. But anyway, so what happened is, it was back earlier, it was around 2002, 2003, can't remember exactly now, but we were called to the scene of a homicide where a husband had shot his wife to death. And she had been she'd been tied up and shot. Oh, and it was a really sad scene, really, really sad in that just any time you have the husband and wife dynamic and
domestic violence, it's the worst,
yeah,
isn't it?
Exactly. Domestic violence, that the trust of marriage is betrayed and the person is killed. It's really sad. And I think, you know, when you are married yourself or have children yourself and you can relate to these circumstances, it's a really sad case. And so
you should walk out. You know, you don't kill the person.
Just say,
you know what, I'm done with you, and off you go. But, all right, go ahead.
Well, that happens so often. It is tragic. You're much more, statistically, much more likely to be murdered by someone you're in a relationship with than a stranger. It really is the case.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But anyway, so we get to this scene, and and unlike the show, in the show they have, you know, someone taking pictures for a few minutes and someone doing, you know, pretty fancy things, and then they're done, and then they know who did it 40 minutes later. In reality, to work a homicide scene takes hours and hours and sometimes days. And so we all had our individual assignments that were given to us, and I was the crime scene photographer, and my friend Mitch was given the task of sketching the scene. And so because he was sketching the scene, he was in the actual murder scene for a long time. He was in with the deceased woman a long time working on his sketch. And while he was there, he started to get that creepy feeling where the skin and the hair on the back of his neck would raise up, and he just started to kind of feel, you know, a little odd. But, you know, he shrugged it off, and it was, you know, kind of an emotional scene, like I said. And so he thought, well, it's just, you know, all in my head. Well, a little further on, he's in there, he's sketching, and, you know, other people are coming and going. But like I said, he's there alone for a while. All of a sudden, the lights go out. The power in the whole house went out for about 30 seconds. No other house on the block experienced that.
Just that one.
Just that house. And so when the lights were out, he's in the scene alone with this deceased person, and he starts to feel really creepy, to use a scientific term. He really creepy.
Yeah.
And so the lights come back on, and, you know, he kind of shrugs it off again, and then he starts working, and it happens again. And so at this point, he's starting to feel, you know, quite a bit creeped out. But then, you know, we come in and, you know, the scene is completed, and I think we were there for 12 hours or something like that. It was a long time at this crime scene, and then we went on. So he thinks it's the end of it, doesn't think much about it. But when he got home, and in the days following this investigation, his dog, who is a very adorable pug named Dude, and there's a picture of him on the Facebook page for the Lost Stones. If anybody wants to see a picture of Dude, go to my Facebook page. But the dog starts to act very, very strange. And up to this point, the dog hadn't behaved in this way at all. But what the dog would do is it would sit in the corner of the room, and he would stare off in a blank part of the room, and he was watching something.
Yeah, he saw something, sensed something.
He did. His head would move as if he was following something. His eyes would go up and down, just like he was watching a person or another animal or something in the corner, but there was nothing there. And so Mitch is watching this, and he's like, well, that's a little weird. And he starts to notice that it's going on more and more frequently after he had returned home from this scene. And he doesn't think much about it. And then the dog started to act even more bizarre. If Mitch would go into the bathroom, the dog would freak out. It would bark. It would claw at the door. It would run around. It just was acting very strange. And so he's starting to wonder, you know, what's wrong with my dog? Why is it behaving this way? It never has acted this way before. Well, a strange thing started to happen around his house as well.
Let's come right back to that spot, Paul, when we come back in just a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, you know, there aren't many things you can get with a quarter nowadays. But one thing you can get, a StreamLink subscription. That's right. Becoming a Coast Insider, a member of the club, for less than 25 cents a day. I originally wanted 1,000 new members a month. I'm going to change that. I want 2,000 new members a month because we've already reached our goal for October. And so I want to extend it. And we're going to do that now. 2,000 members for the month of October. And we're going to do this in November, December, and on and on and on. For 25 cents a day, simply go to coasttocoastam.com, click the Coast Insiders line that you'll see at the top of the homepage, fill out the info, and you're part of the club. And we'll be back in a moment more with Paul Ramosh and his book, The Lost Stones, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. We're with Paul Ramosh. So, Paul, the dog dude was acting weird, seemed to be seeing things, sensing things, and then you were saying strange things were happening at this guy's house. Go ahead.
Yeah, what would happen is the power in his room started to go out during the night. He would wake up and his clock was blinking. He could tell that that the power had gone out in his room, but nothing else in the whole house seemed to have been affected. And so he notices these strange things, and he doesn't think much of it. He's not necessarily putting it together yet. Then one day, he starts to go out with this girl. He begins to date this girl, and she was an intuitive. And so when she came over to his house the first time, she felt that there was a presence there.
Mm-hmm.
And as she began to observe the dog's behavior, she put it all together and started to ask Mitch questions. And she said, have you been to a scene recently where a female was murdered? Or I think she originally asked, have you been to a death scene recently? And Mitch is like, well, yeah, we go to them all the time. You know, it's part of the job. And
sure.
So she started to ask some more specific questions and eventually pretty much nailed down that this spirit who had followed Mitch home was from the homicide that we had described. And her feelings on it were, and I think this is really interesting, and this is where I would love to hear some feedback from some fellow first responders, is that this girlfriend of Mitch's, this intuitive, felt that this murdered woman had felt betrayed. In this, you know, the most sacred of all relationships that we have, man and wife, she had felt so betrayed by being murdered by her husband that this spirit looked to latch on to someone that she could trust. And maybe it was because Mitch spent a lot of time in the scene with her or whatever it was, but she latched on for him for safety so she could feel safe and avoid or try to put behind her this feeling of betrayal. And so she followed Mitch home.
And, you know, he's lucky. It could have been worse.
Yeah.
Could have been worse. Now, how about you, Paul? Has anything happened to you?
Well, probably the strangest thing that's happened to me is, I guess that there's been times when I've been at a crime scene and you can feel a murder scene and you can feel the presence of the departed person there. And it's kind of weird. And I don't think a lot of people like to talk about it, but there was a murder scene fairly early on in my career where we spent a week processing this scene. It was a very intricate scene. There was a lot of blood spatter evidence that we had to reconstruct. And that's a time consuming process. You don't just go and snap a few pictures. You need to photograph everything in detail and mark it and have rulers. And, you know, it's a quite intricate process. And so we were there for about a week. And when we would come into the scene, you could feel this girl's presence there. And it was so strong, and everybody on our team could feel it, that we would begin to, when we would walk in the scene, we would say hello to this girl. You could feel it. And, you know, maybe that sounds strange to a lot of people, but it was very real. And in this case, I had the sense that she understood why we were there. that she understood that we were trying to help her and that she was glad we were there. And so as far as the sensation, that's probably the most paranormal experience I've had at a scene. But I did have kind of an interesting experience at the very haunted Ben Lomond Hotel here in Ogden, Utah.
What kind of hotel is that?
Well, it's a hotel that it's, I believe it's on the National Register of Haunted Places. It is really one of the most haunted places in Utah. And Ogden, the city where I live, Ogden has quite a colorful past. Ogden's name is the Junction City because it was a railroad hub. Back in the golden age of railroad, you couldn't travel from the East Coast to the West Coast or vice versa without having to stop in Ogden. All the train traffic going from coast to coast stopped in Ogden.
Yeah, everything was there.
Yeah, and it has quite a colorful past. And there was, you know, during Prohibition, there was lots of speakeasies, there was lots of brothels, and there's even this system of tunnels that were built from the train station to under Wall Avenue to a lot of where the speakeasies and where the brothels were. And they even extended further into town. And so there's lots of stories of murder and mayhem and all sorts of things in Ogden. So Ogden has this colorful past, and one of the oldest hotel still in town, still standing, is the Ben Lomond Hotel, and there are so many haunted stories and experiences with this hotel, and it's a beautiful building, and it's a really fabulous place. But I had an interesting experience there once, and what happened is we were there. We actually had a call on Halloween night.
Perfect night.
You know, we're coming up on that. And it was actually rather funny because when we went into the lobby, one of the bars that was hooked on to the hotel, lots of the revelers were coming out, and they were in costumes. And my colleague and I were standing there, and people thought that we were in costumes. They would come up, "Hey, what are you supposed to be?" Like, "Well, we're CSIs." "Oh, that's a good costume." Like, "No, we're really CSIs." "Oh, what?" You know, and they didn't believe us. And then we showed them our radios and our badges, and then it kind of sunk in. But what happened, and we had to ride up the elevator, and it was packed with revelers, people coming out, going up to their rooms after coming out of the bars. And the elevator got stuck on the fifth floor. And so we're just packed shoulder to shoulder in this elevator with these people. And we were there. We were stuck for quite a while on the fifth floor. You know, it seemed like forever with, you know, a drunk person breathing in your face. But once we got out, we were probably stuck for probably 2-3 minutes. Well, and once we got out and went back to the office, we looked up the Ben Lomond Hotel, to the different haunting stories. And that is one of the haunting stories. That's one of the frequent things, is that the elevator always stops and gets stuck on the fifth floor. So unbeknownst to me at the time, we had, you know, become part of the lore of the Ben Lomond.
You know, it's incredible, Paul, that these stories abound. Next hour, we will open up a phone line for the Special Law Enforcement Line to see what they've seen when they're on the scenes of some of these places. Have you ever felt threatened or uneasy at one of these events?
I haven't. And like I said, the homicide that I mentioned, that's the only time where I really felt, a presence, and I felt that she knew we were there to help her. And so, as far as my experience with, you know, being at a crime scene, that's it. I thought that they, or that this spirit understood that we were there to help them, and that's why I would be interested to hear what some of my fellow law enforcement people have to say on it.
Okay,
now, another story with the Ben Lomond Hotel, and this, I don't know if this person felt threatened, but it was a much more dramatic story. What happened is a few years ago, it was the night before Thanksgiving, and some people had damaged some property in a different hotel in Ogden. And I was there taking pictures of some of this damaged property, and these guys were caught, you know, these pictures would be part of their restitution. And a security guard from this hotel was taking me through the scene. And so I started talking to him a little bit and, you know, just kind of a small talk. And he told me that he used to work at the Ben Lomond Hotel. And so, you know, over the years, I've tried to collect as many of these ghost stories as I could. And so I said, oh, well, you know, that hotel's really haunted, isn't it? And at first, you could tell he didn't want to tell me the stories. I don't know if he thought I was going to make fun of him or what, but I, you know, kind of told him some of the different stories that I've heard over the years, and that loosened him up, and he began to tell me some stories. And he actually quit working at the Ben Lomond because he was tired of, for lack of a better term, the spiritual harassment.
Hmm.
So many things happened to the maids and the security guards working at night that they have a hard time keeping people.
He just had enough, huh?
Yeah, and a lot of times, most of his paranormal experiences where he would be walking up the stairs or doing a check and he would feel breath on the back of his neck, and he would turn around and nobody was there. And, you know, that happened quite a bit. But I think the story or the incident that shook him and made him leave is that one night he was walking across the lobby. It's a very beautiful lobby, high ceilings and nice floor and columns and just a very beautiful place. And he was walking across the lobby, and coming the other direction was a elderly woman. And he didn't think much of it. She looked just like an elderly woman walking across. But he said she had kind of a faraway look in her eye. And so when he got close to her, he said, you know, ma'am, can I help you? And she didn't say anything, but just kept walking on past him. So he took a few steps and then turned around to look at her again. And guess what?
She's gone.
And that really shook him because, I mean, she looked like a person. It wasn't an ethereal, wispy form. She looked like a person, and, yeah, she was gone. And so that really shook him, and, yeah, he got a job at a little safer hotel in town.
that was it for him.
Yeah.
When you wrote the book, The Lost Stones, and you got into forbidden archaeology, give me your definition. What do you mean by forbidden archaeology? Now, we've talked about that, of course, with Michael Cremo, but I'd like to get your take.
Well, and of course, that term forbidden archaeology is a coast-to-coast term. It is, you can't say that without conjuring Michael Cremo, because his work is really groundbreaking in the field. But my definition of it would be that it is archaeological proof of things out there that the mainstream of science and academia doesn't want you to know about. And they'll either ignore it or suppress it or go after the people who purport it. And it's something that they don't want people to know about.
Well, let's get into some of the specifics on this. And do you find that you were at conflict at all with your role as a forensic scientist and forbidden archaeology?
You know, I think if we look at, you know, the mainstream of thought, I think that there is kind of a conflict. But as I said before, I think as a forensic scientist, you really have to go where the evidence takes you. It is so dangerous in my line of work to ignore evidence and pursue doggedly a theory that you have. And, I mean, that's when people do that, that's where innocent people go to jail. I mean, if you ignore the evidence that you find at a crime scene and have a preconceived notion that a certain person is guilty, there's going to be trouble and there's going to be violation of people's rights and a horrible miscarriage of justice. And so that's really the mindset that I've always had. And so when you come across different evidences that I've learned about in research and reading and here on Coast to Coast, it's almost impossible to not follow where the evidence goes. And I think one of the most interesting, and I use this a lot in my novels, is a plot device, and you know, one of the main things is the Michigan artifacts. And I first heard about the Michigan artifacts right here on Coast to Coast. But what's amazing about the Michigan artifacts is, so in the mid to late 1800s, you had farmers going into the upper Midwest, Michigan, but also neighboring states.
Mm-hmm.
And as they began to dig into these mounds, as they were digging post holes and clearing fields and doing these things, they found artifacts. They found metal weapons. They found clay objects. They found slate tablets. And as they looked at them, they had writing on them. They had writing that looked hieroglyphic in nature, some parts Egyptian and some parts Hebrew and some other Mediterranean languages. They found these artifacts had depictions of biblical stories, the creation, the flood, the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. They found these things, and they were shocked because, well, what is this stuff doing here? Why are there scenes from the Bible? Why are we digging them up? So they go to the Native Americans who live in their area and say, hey, did your ancestors or these artifacts part of what your people left behind? And the Native Americans, almost with one accord, said, no, those were left behind by a race of light-skinned people that our ancestors actually destroyed. And so the people finding these artifacts, and even different scholars who began to research them, came to the conclusion that, well, obviously somebody traveled from the old world here and had a culture here,
mm-hmm.
and the Indians destroyed them. And so that's logically where this evidence leads. But that's not where we stand, because different scholars, and a lot of this research was led by John Wesley Powell of Lake Powell fame out here in Utah. He was the head of the Smithsonian Department of Ethnology. He comes onto the scene and looks at these artifacts and says, no. There's no evidence here that these came from someone who crossed the ocean.
He didn't want anything to do with it.
Nope. He concluded, you're absolutely right, he concluded, nope, these are just left behind by the ancestors of the Native Americans, and that's it. And so at that point, kind of academic favor turned against these Michigan artifacts and things that were found, and they were dismissed. And what the Native Americans said, they were dismissed as myth. And Your guest who follows me knows all about scholars dismissing the words of ancient people as myth. And anybody who dared to find these artifacts, they were called hoaxers.
Yeah.
And a smear campaign happened, and it really follows a pattern that the mainstream archaeologists and mainstream scientists do to anything that they consider to be against what they want to tell us.
Do you find that most of the evidence is really subjective, that it's not hard evidence, it's more of visualization or faith-type evidence?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, if you... The faith that we have, whether you believe in the Bible or the Book of Mormon or the Quran or the teachings of Buddha, the faith that a person has, it really is kind of a different part of our brain. You know, the things that you believe, the things that make you feel good, the things that make you feel like you're connecting with your Creator, those are more, I think, on our emotional side.
Paul, stay with us. We're going to come back, talk more, take calls on Coast to Coast AM.